I think the challenge that the Biden administration faces is that the world has changed and the U.S. has changed.
And that is one of the challenges for the new U.S. president. This is Thursday, January 28th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the new U.S. Secretary of State tells his staff they have their work cut out for them. New orders from the president pushing for racial equity for Asian Americans and others. Indonesia battles over a million cases of COVID. And nursing students see virtual patients stepping in for real ones. That and more on today's VOA Asia. As the 46th president of the United States continues to settle into his Oval Office, he faces a slew of difficult problems, not the least of which is how to deal with what many consider to be a loss of trust among allies at a number of international hotspots. Today, we at VOA Asia continue our examination of what lies ahead for Joe Biden when it comes to relations with Asian nations. We examine how the U.S. might deal with North Korea with the help of the VOA Korea Service. We've listened to their Washington Talk TV program as they spoke with two experts on North Korea, William Newcomb, a former member of the U.N. Sanctions Committee on North Korea, and Scott Snyder, the director of U.S.-Korea Policy at the American Foreign Relations Association. It is Snyder's prediction that President Biden will seek to turn back the clock when it comes to North Korea.
We can see evidence of that in the return to the climate change agreement and U.S. rejoining WHO. But I think the challenge that the Biden administration faces is that the world has changed and the U.S. has changed. And so I think the question is, how will the U.S. efforts to provide global leadership be greeted or challenged by the world? And then can the U.S. sustain international leadership in the face of enormous domestic challenges?
A major part of U.S. relations with North Korea has been what is termed top-down, referring to the summit meetings between President Trump and DPRK leader Kim Jong-un. William Newcomb sees Biden's policy as at least starting off in a different way.
I think we're going to see more bottom-up, very little top-down. But at the same time, should lower-level talks create an opportunity for potential breakthroughs, I wouldn't rule out President Biden stepping in at an appropriate time. But I think you would have to have some deals pretty soundly in place before he made that kind of political commitment.
Newcomb says the U.S. should expand its North Korea focus beyond that of denuclearization.
I certainly would hope that they not only look at what the Trump administration did, but they would also go back as far as agreed framework and take an unflinching look at the sequence of policy failures that have dogged our efforts to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles. And, you know, we really need to broaden our targets. They have pretty sophisticated chemical weapons perfected in Syria in actual use. They have they pose a terrific cyber threat and do a lot of cyber thefts. And we have the human rights issues, too. So we have a lot more things to address than just what has been the sole focus of all these past years.
President Biden's Secretary of State Tony Blinken has said he feels the situation between the United States and North Korea has worsened. Snyder agrees.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the case that it's gotten worse. We saw the tests from 2017, but since then we see just this year North Korea's expression of intent to continue in developing the submarine-launched ballistic missile capability. We see an emphasis on developing tactical nuclear weapons, possibly for battlefield use. And the big issue, I think, that the Biden administration faces is whether or not Kim Jong-un and North Korea are going to redirect a shift in intentions. We saw that summitry was successful inducing some measure of restraint and expressed intent by North Korea. But now North Korea has gone back to this formulation of hostile policy, and they've expressed that that hostile policy is unending. And so in the context of that formulation with regard to perceptions of U.S. intent, it raises some big questions about what North Korea's intent is going to be going forward.
Newcomb agrees and adds there is even more cause for concern.
We have a threat of renewed proliferation. You have to recall that North Korea committed the worst acts of proliferation ever when it built the nuclear reactor in Syria that Israel destroyed. It also was helping Libya when Gaddafi had his nuclear program going on. And so the concern now is, will it resume this kind of activity? Would it even entertain proliferation to non-state actors, which has always been, I think, a very grave concern when looking at the North Korean threat. It's not just missiles flying toward U.S. possessions or the U.S. mainland. It's a much bigger issue than that.
So what can be done? Sanctions, says Newcomb, but not the way they have so far been applied.
Sanctions need to be, in my view, more fully enforced. And they never really were. We have a tool that we have failed to utilize to its maximum effect. And if you look at more recent reports by the panel of experts, they have documented exhaustively a number of violations, and they have named and shamed the people that did it. But what consequences have there been? Probably no more than a New York City parking ticket issued to a diplomat.
Our thank you to the VOA Korea Service for contributing to this series of reports. Please join us tomorrow for an examination of President Biden and Southeast Asia. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Indonesia's most active volcano, Mount Merapi, on the island of Java, erupted Wednesday, sending up a cloud of ash as well as lava flows. A man convicted and later acquitted in the 2002 killing of American journalist Daniel Pearl admits a minor role in his death in Pakistan. Myanmar Wednesday started that country's COVID-19 vaccination program with healthcare workers and medical volunteers the first to receive the shots donated by India. Competition venues in Japan's Sapporo City say they're ready to host Olympic events. Bangladesh will move 2,000 to 3,000 more Rohingya Muslims to a remote island. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. This is VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived for his first day of work Wednesday, reminding his department that they have their work cut out for them, but they will succeed by rebuilding trust and transparency.
The world is watching us intently right now. They want to know if we can heal our nation. They want to see whether we will lead with the power of our example, if we'll put a premium on diplomacy with our allies and partners to meet the great challenges of our time. So we've got our work cut out for us. But I am confident we will succeed. The United States has enormous sources of strength. We're going to build upon them. America's values are noble and powerful, and we will recommit to them. And America's leadership is needed around the world, and we'll provide it, because the world is far more likely to solve problems and meet challenges when the United States is there. America at its best still has a greater capacity than any other nation on earth to mobilize others for the better.
U.S. senators voted 78-22 to approve Blinken, the longtime Biden confidant, as the nation's 71st Secretary of State, succeeding Mike Pompeo. The position is the most senior cabinet position, with the secretary fourth in the line of presidential succession. Blinken, who is 58, served as Deputy Secretary of State and Deputy National Security Advisor during the Obama administration. Happening now in Asia, the Nikkei newspaper reports AstraZeneca will license Japanese biotechnology company JCR Pharmaceutical to produce some 90 million doses of its COVID-19 vaccine to help Japan avoid shortages and delays. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. President Joe Biden Tuesday signed a series of executive orders that the White House says will advance racial equity for Americans who have been underserved and left behind. Biden's moves disavow racism and xenophobia, including of the type directed at Asian Americans following the rise of the coronavirus pandemic. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekaswara has the story.
The quest for racial justice has been front and center in the U.S. since the death of George Floyd in police custody last May.
It was the knee on the neck of justice, and it wouldn't be forgotten. It stirred the conscience and of tens of millions of Americans. And in my view, it marked a turning point in this country's attitude toward racial justice.
On Tuesday, President Joe Biden signed four executive orders that the White House says will advance racial equity for Americans who have been underserved and left behind.
These aren't feel-good policies. The evidence is clear. Investing in equity is good for economic growth, and it creates jobs for all Americans.
Biden's actions reversed several Trump administration policies. He directed agencies to strengthen anti-discrimination laws on federal housing and end the Justice Department's use of private prisons, which activists say compound racial disparities. While the rate of black imprisonment has decreased in recent years, it is still more than five times the rate of white incarceration.
If you have a for-profit system that then pays people based upon the number of people in it, they're going to want to put more and more people in it. And so the incentives are all wrong in terms of being able to deal with the better societal objectives of public safety and the rehabilitation of members of our society.
Biden is also recommitting the U.S. government to better consultation with the nation's 574 federally recognized Native American tribes. And he wants to combat discrimination against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders that intensified in the early days of the pandemic.
People who look Asian, people who look Chinese are being identified as having the virus.
Biden's push for equity, distributing resources with focus on the needs of minorities, is criticized by conservatives who say true equality means giving everyone the same resources no matter who they are.
This definition of equity by the left is unequal treatment in order to obtain equal outcomes. That is not who we are. That is what Marxism pretends to do, to obtain equal outcomes. We do not have equal outcomes. We allow people to flourish.
Biden's racial equity agenda seeks to deliver for people who helped him win the White House. Black voters make up 11% of the electorate in 2020, and more than 90% of them voted for Biden. Patsy Wiedekaswara, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. China said Wednesday it was seeking details about 25 of its nationals who were among 61 crew on two supertankers seized by Indonesia on suspicion of illegally transferring oil. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Indonesia officially surpassed 1 million coronavirus cases Tuesday, a grim milestone for the Southeast Asian nation that has struggled since last March to get the COVID-19 pandemic under control. Emily Wither reports.
It's a familiar situation across the world, but no less shocking. In Indonesia, the hospitals are full of patients gasping for breath. And graves are being hastily dug. The Southeast Asian nation officially passing a grim milestone Tuesday, 1 million coronavirus cases. The world's fourth most populous country has struggled since last March to get the COVID-19 pandemic under control. Deaths from the respiratory disease now total 28,468. Those numbers are among the highest across Asia. Health experts believe the true spread of the disease could be three times higher. West Java has been facing some of the highest infection rates across the country. Reuters spoke to residents in Bogor, a city south of Jakarta on Java Island.
This situation is very worrying. Maybe it's the lack of public awareness, but in my opinion, people just don't want to know about the situation, or they don't care about it. Things like wearing masks and washing hands should be mandatory. But even in big cities, they don't consider it an obligation.
If we believe that COVID will attack us, it will definitely attack us. But if we are sure that COVID will not attack us and we surrender to God, we will definitely not get it.
The Indonesian government started a mass vaccination campaign and tightened movement restrictions earlier this month. It can't come soon enough as hospitals come under mounting strain. Dozens of COVID-19 patients have reportedly been turned away due to a lack of beds and ventilators.
Correspondent Emily Wither reporting. Happening in Asia, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga apologized Wednesday after lawmakers from his ruling coalition visited nightclubs despite his government's call for people to avoid unnecessary outings to curb the spread of COVID-19. Stay with us for the latest news from and about Asia at voanews.com and all of our digital platforms. Heavily dependent on tourism and exports, Thailand is one of Asia's worst-hit economies by the coronavirus. Now, as a second wave strikes, an unpopular government is desperately trying to avoid more economic damage. Vichitra Dwangdi has more from Bangkok.
Immaculate lawns and life-sized models of dinosaurs. A magical world awaits visitors to the Nongnut Garden near the Thai resort of Pattaya. Before the pandemic, nearly 10,000 tourists would flock here every day. Now there are only a handful.
We have a new outbreak of COVID-19 at the moment. We barely have any visitors now. We only had around 100 today.
The owner says that he's trying to keep his army of workers in jobs without the usual income he gets from tourism. Now, a second wave of the coronavirus is doubling the economic pain. The borders are closed, and the all-important Chinese visitors are staying home, rubbing out Thailand's $60 billion tourism annual take. The country's GDP is expected to contract by at least 6% this year, leaving many to turn to a government that is running out of cash. After a record $58 billion stimulus package in the spring of 2020, it has offered just $7 billion in relief for round two of the pandemic.
The government is now looking at more injecting and more stimulus and more money to spend, but we don't have that much more money. If you are looking at right now, some sectors such as tourism is asking for specific help in sustaining employment. I think why that is a reasonable thing to ask for, it will be difficult to decide which sector the government is going to help.
Thailand's vast service sector has also taken a hard blow. Small businesses are sinking in debt after shutdowns, mass job losses, and a collapse in consumer spending. 20 million others get by in the informal sector, self-reliant and cut off from government support in times of crisis. Among them is Fun. Every day he takes his bicycle and two young daughters to work, mending shoes, mostly in the tourist areas of Bangkok. He used to make around $23 a day. Now he only brings in less than a third of that.
I'm the only one in the family that works to support my wife, my two kids, as well as my sister, niece, and nephew. There are virtually no customers because of COVID, so I don't make nearly enough to feed my family.
Hope is in short supply as the wheels come off the Thai economy. Vichitra Dwangdi for VOA News, Bangkok.
We continue on VOA Asia. Virtual patients are stepping in for real ones and allowing nursing students to continue their training during the pandemic. Tina Trin reports.
Do you ever get headaches?
Yeah, I get them a lot when I'm studying.
Tina Jones is a virtual patient, and you're her nurse. And to be a good one, you must ask the right questions, just like in the real world.
You would actually have to start the conversation.
David Messias is describing Shadow Health, a virtual training simulation for nurses and healthcare professionals. Recently acquired by health science publisher Elsevier, Shadow Health relies largely on what nurses in training say or write to patients.
That conversation engine truly evaluates how a student's effectiveness of interviewing, examining a patient through conversation.
Can you tell me more about your headaches?
When I get one, it's just kind of tight and throbbing.
The greatest strength, in my opinion, is the ability to ask an avatar a question and have them respond to you.
Lori Rilko teaches nursing students at George Washington University and says Shadow Health provides a safe environment in which students can practice and build their confidence.
They get to practice what questions to ask and how to ask it to get the information that's so crucial to make that diagnosis.
The virtual simulation includes a diverse set of patients with real-life symptoms.
They can listen to their heart and hear real heart sounds. They can look in their eyes and their ears.
Students learn to navigate sensitive discussions, too, like when signs of physical abuse are present. Shadow Health's technology lets students safely continue their education during the pandemic.
Not only just for the course-based instruction, but also for the clinical hour requirements that are necessary to become a registered nurse.
At a time when nurses are needed more than ever, virtual simulations are giving them the space to learn. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
The U.S. state of Florida is cracking down to prevent non-state residents from receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. That after a large number of people got the shot ahead of Florida residents. The vaccine rollout in Florida, as in other states, has faced problems, in large part because of vaccine supply shortages. Livia Anisimova in Miami has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Over 1.2 million people have received COVID-19 vaccines in Florida. The vaccine is free and can be given at special vaccination points, large malls, nursing homes, supermarkets, and pharmacies.
Not only was Florida the first state in the nation to vaccinate more than 500,000 seniors, but we are rapidly approaching reporting 1 million vaccinations just to Florida seniors.
Up until recently, it had been easy to qualify. A document with the date of birth was enough. But now, those who want to get vaccinated will need to prove they are Florida residents. The reason for the new requirement is the result of the new data from the state health department, showing that 39,000 vaccine recipients live outside Florida. Exceptions are made, however, for medical workers, seasonal residents, and property owners. The decision of local authorities to allow vaccinations only to Florida residents was met with mixed responses.
Well, it doesn't make any sense because until we're all vaccinated, nobody's safe. It's as simple as that, really. So it's the wrong decision.
I agree totally.
I would say so, too.
You know, I'm vaccinated if each one lives in a state. That's your residence. So if you want... Talk to your congressman, senator, mayor, whomever, and try to get and push it there. But it's true. We don't have enough over here because we have a lot of people that come to Miami and they want to do it. And this is not tourism. This is for our lives.
The reason for the change is that, like in many states, there just isn't enough vaccine in Florida to go around. Until the supply meets the demand, state officials will restrict who can get the vaccine. Those seeking to get the COVID-19 shot in Florida will now have to provide two forms of identification, one of which can prove they're a state resident. For Lilia Anisimova in Miami, Florida, NRI's VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. And you can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thank you for being with us. Our thank you to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. They include Amy Heibel, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay healthy and enjoy the day ahead.